Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, do you know what your strength, intelligence, and charisma scores are? We're going to figure out how to stat real people in D&D and other games. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the conversation, everyone, I will remind you that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a private video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server with all of our patrons. And you can join in by simply joining our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you will get an invite to our Discord server. And coming in a little bit after 2 p.m. Eastern, we will kick that off, and we'll continue the conversation there. Hope to see you.
We love that part of every week. So, Paul, we were, I think I was with you last week, actually, right? I was with you in the last episode in person.
Yeah.
We were doing an event. Right. I remember that.
Yeah. Remember when we didn't step on each other's sentences? Those are good times.
That weekend we also ran a game for some friends of ours and got to see some folks that I don't personally get to see in the Boston area quite so much. And one of our friends, several of our friends, which we might not have guessed about any of ourselves, have gotten into weightlifting are very, you know, fitness minded at the moment as we get more mature. And we sat down and asked the question in classic D&D, I can currently lift this in classic D&D, what should my strength score be? And I was starting to rack my head about exactly what the old school rules were. And I think I got pretty close, but I looked it up later. So I thought it was an interesting idea. And it also brought to mind to our understanding Dave Arneson's very first fantasy game in what we now know as Blackmoor was a bunch of people come over and you play yourselves. Yeah. The story here is you're on a plane that's been transported through the Bermuda Triangle or something like that, and you've landed in a fantasy world, and your stats are actually based on what you, the players, actually sitting at the table are like, which I don't think many people would do nowadays, but it's an interesting idea. And I do think that it becomes more relevant as you try to gauge the in-game abilities and statistics and capacities to, again, I'm fond of basing that stuff on real-world capacities to kind of give you a stable grounding of the decisions that you're making. So I thought it was interesting of exactly how do you convert real people into D&D stats or other games?
I mean, it's fascinating. I've definitely... definitely played games. I'm trying to think of it. Is this true? I've certainly heard of games, and I'm trying to think of whether or not I really played them or not, of where players are encouraged to just play themselves, right? You're just yourself in this weird, unusual situation. And I feel like, honestly, when it comes to like, yeah, but we're using like standardized D&D or similar RPG mechanics, and now you have to create stats for yourself, I feel like that's where it maybe gets a little wobbly, and it's not such a great idea.
Yes, I have. Right. I have seen cases where that does get strange, as a matter of fact. Yes. When I was researching this, I guess there is a particular field called kinanthropometry that is specifically the study of human size, shape, proportion, gross function in order to understand exercise and performance and nutrition, things like that. For what it's worth, my sister actually has an advanced degree in kinesiology, which is pretty related. And people like that frequently go into sports training type of careers. So once again, this kind of lands surprisingly, this issue lands surprisingly close to myself. So probably our viewers wouldn't be too surprised that this is the kind of thing I like to lean into. myself. So now some ability scores are clearly easier to measure than others. Would you agree with that, Paul, or would you disagree with that?
I would disagree with that. I think they're all incredibly difficult to measure. And I generally think that, I mean, the problem with it is that they're gross generalizations and they're things that, you know, people have struggled with, you know, for ages. I guess I would say that maybe it's at least a more productive conversation to have when you're talking about the physical attributes rather than the mental or social attributes. And maybe it's a, you know, there's easier ways to ascribe numbers to things, I guess, right? Like, I mean, the conversation started, right, based on strength, and we're talking about how much weight can you lift, and is that an accurate measure of strength, right? But I can't help but think about, over the past few weeks, I've been watching the Olympics. I mean, and these are people at the top of their form, right, who have been training physically to do a specific activity of one kind or another, and these people are in tip-top athletic shape. But based on what sport you're looking at, that looks very different, right? If you look at a gymnast versus, you know, versus a swimmer versus a, I don't know what else have I seen recently? You know, a break dancer? I don't know. It's very different. They end up in very different physical shapes as they've trained their bodies to do a very specific activity.
Totally, totally correct. And I'll briefly point out, I think just at the moment while we're live, I think we have the title from last week's episode duplicated, and we'll fix that immediately after we get off here. Sorry about that, everybody, but we are live here on the Sunday post-Olympics, right? Last week was mid-Olympics. Now we can reflect on what happened in the Olympics. So that's actually a really excellent point there, Paul. So let's look at strength. Okay, so strength, great. Physical ability, like Paul is talking about there, it has perennially been the first ability score in classic Dungeons & Dragons forever. So maybe we can at least try to get a grip, you might say. Let's just talk about the strength ability, which is where this question came from. Now, original D&D, you know, very, very sketchy, obviously, very rudimentary, didn't have any kind of parameters like this. But if you go forward to first edition, advanced D&D, at some point, actually, like all the books did actually touch on this kind of issue. And in particular, there's a fuller description of the ability scores in a Dungeon Master's Guide. So, Paul, I do have a bunch of text images. Mm-hmm. Had a chance to pull those up. So it's going to be a text-heavy day on the images. And the red dot would be the one that I have from the first edition ability scores. So here I just snipped out what Gygax wrote in first edition about strength and intelligence. And in particular, if you jump down to exceptional strength, what it says there is, assume further that a strength of 18 indicates that the creature can lift weight equal to its own body weight or 180 pounds, whichever is greater, above its head. So, you know, so there's some kind of rule of thumb there. If we ignore the body weight issue, strength of 18 is 180 pounds over the head. So maybe that means just like 10 pounds per strength point is maybe what they're talking about there. So that gives you a pretty concrete specific. And I think that for our friends that we were talking with last week, if it is just 10 pounds per strength point, then, you know, which is a fairly robust strength for modern people. And Gary wrote in other places that, you know, remember, we're talking medieval ancient people that were doing a lot more physical work than probably we do nowadays. My strength score might be 8, I guess. Now here I am stumbling into the statting yourself out bit. And I think our friends would be at a strength of like 8 or 9 or something like that. So I don't mind having a rule of thumb like that.
I mean, it's fine, right? Like for a game, I guess it's interesting to me, I think, because when we're talking about fictional characters, I think it's fine to make these generalizations, right? But I struggle with it when we're talking about like real people and you're trying to classify real human beings. Again, like I feel like it's just such a broad stroke thing, right? Okay, so you're talking about the ability to lift weight over your head. But isn't that different, say, from the strength to just say climb a mountain, right? Or hang on or lift or hold for a long duration of time. Is that, and are we starting to get into the realm of constitution rather than strength if we're talking about that kind of endurance or ability to hold a weight for a longer period of time, or is that still strength?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question about like what ability score relates to what kind of capacity, and in like particularly climbing stuff. I think I have asked a couple of friends that do rock climbing stuff whether, because in some rules, obviously you consider dexterity. I mean, thieves climb and thieves have good dexterity, so I guess dexterity is for climbing. And I think most of the time, when I ask to do rock climbing, they usually say the thing that you need more of is actually the strength. You need to be flexible in order to reach, like, you know, more further out handholds, perhaps. But unless my memory is failing me, they usually say that being able to be like strong to pull yourself up from a small grip is kind of the more important thing. But
no, I've been rock climbing, and I can tell you that the majority of it, you actually don't want to pull yourself up with your arms. You want to use your legs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like my ability to lift a weight over my head, I could do that from a seated position. Right. And that has nothing to do with my ability to climb with my legs. Now, you're not saying that there's no upper body. There's certainly upper body strength,
right?
Because you're trying to hold yourself against the wall. And grip strength becomes an important factor for sure.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, it's interesting because so they presumably if they had to pick, you know, one thing here, and obviously we know that strength is one of these gross measurements and presumably it hopefully relates to all these things. The part when our friend asked us, the part that I couldn't immediately remember is specifically what lift Gary mentioned here. And I couldn't remember whether it was a bench press or a squat or a deadlift or this overhead press that he picked there. So initially misremembering, I thought it was a bench press and therefore I thought it had a higher strength score than I do. So I was a little bit miffed when I saw what it actually was. But, you know, I think I'm okay with that. It is a, you know, picking one thing as your initial basis is not too bad. And it's one that does actually give a arguably not terrible, you know, 10 pounds per point. Now, some of our viewers are asking things like, when did the bend bars and lift gates come in? And that was this edition, right? Over in the player's handbook, they have those percentages to win there. And obviously, many of us are grousing about the presence of exceptional strength. And of course, in advanced D&D, when you got packs 18 only in strength and only for fighters, then you also rolled percentile dice, so you might have 18-1 or 18-50 or 18-100. And this paragraph goes on to much more rapidly accelerate how much you can lift if you are in that 18 percentage category. And you get some extra points up to 50, and then you get 4 pounds per point up to 90, and then you get 8 pounds per point up to 100. And if you add it all up, the top level there, if you do have 1800 strength. And now I've never seen a character with that, but I actually have seen a player character with 1899 strength get rolled up in front of you, as a matter of fact. But if you do have 1800 strength and you add this all up, then the overhead lift that you'd get out of this rule will be 470 pounds.
In this edition, again, I haven't played a lot with exceptional strength. It's certainly not in a long time. It's not a rule I ever was very fond of. But didn't Gauntlets of Ogre Strength give you 18-00?
I believe so.
Yeah. So I feel like that's more often where that came up for me is through magic, not through.
Good point.
Like, I happened to roll that stat. Yeah.
Good point. Yep. Excellent point there. You're right. And now we might compare that, right? We might. So if I look up, on an amateur basis, just what I can find on websites, I see like health and fitness sites that state for, depending on your age, gender, your body weight, things like that. So if I look up like a male that weighs 180 pounds, I've seen sites say that you're an advanced lifter if you can overhead press like around 190. 190 is you're an advanced lifter, and then if you can lift something like 240, you're elite, not a pro, not like an Olympic level pro. And I think if you do look it up, like overhead type lifts, like a clean and jerk or a snatch, the world records are in the high 400s, 500 pounds area. So the 470 that this gives you is kind of in the ballpark of the world record of like around 500 pounds or something like that for those kinds of exercises. So big difference from the 18 to 1800, but it looks like Gary was kind of looking at some kind of real world numbers there, because it's kind of in the ballpark actually.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that he was looking at real world numbers. Like, what else would you do? Just make stuff up, I guess. Just make it up wildly. I hope it sticks.
That's what we're told. That's what we're told they did in a lot of cases. Now, this guy, so this varies over the editions, right? So, and this is actually something that I did not think of until our friend Morgan actually mentioned this, and they're actually more familiar with more recent editions of D&D. So I didn't even think about the way that this strength issue has changed. So I picked up, I looked up the third edition rule that has an orange dot in the picture. So we're going to look at the table in the player's handbook from third edition. The table's labeled carrying capacity, and the line right at the top says a character can lift up to the maximum load over his or her head. So once again, they're gauging this, if the most concrete thing they're gauging this is on overhead lift here. So the very last number in each row tells you how much they can lift. Now, the interesting thing is that in third edition, obviously, the percentages are gone at 18, which most of us like. They can kind of smoothly continue the numbers up to 19, 20. In this table, it goes all the way up to 29 here. It's not linear, right? So it's not, I guess it's 10 pounds per point up to 10. And then it goes non-linear on you. So 8 strength is 80 and 10 strength is 100. And then it goes non-linear, and by the time you get up to 18 strength, you can now lift 300 pounds overhead, which would be like an elite lifter is what I've seen. And for that, like around 500 pounds, then you'd be like at 22 strength, like 21 or 22 strength would give you high 400s, 500 pound lift, which would be the world record of all time.
And now I'm trying to remember. I don't think third edition had stat increases, right? You weren't like getting stat increases as you leveled up or anything, right? So would you presume without magical aid that a character could not exceed 18 strength in this edition?
I believe it did. I actually think third edition did have that. I got my third edition book right here, just in case a question came up like this.
Yeah. I was just trying to figure out like why,
fourth level.
Every fourth level you get a stat increase. Okay. So you could start getting an ability increase, and then presumably actually work your way up to a 22 strength by leveling up a lot. Okay. Sure.
Yep. And for the viewer, and it's interesting, they actually have a rule for continuing the table. So ultimately, at high levels, you're getting a multiplier of the fourth root of 10 each point of strength, just for you math nerds out there.
Okay.
Or the 10th root of 4. I'm sorry, the 10th root of 4 is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So, yeah. something reasonable. And of course, you know, the main reason why these things are like the main thing you're getting out of this table, of course, is carrying capacity for encumbrance. Kind of tied into that. And then I also pulled up fifth edition, which has a yellow dot on it. Same kind of rationale why you need this. So this is under the description of strength in the fifth edition, the 2014 Player's Handbook. And it is, again, your strength score determines the amount of weight you can bear. Your basic carrying capacity is 15 times your strength score, which is pretty much one stone per strength point, I will point out. But enough about that. But then it says, and it's a little bit more vague under push, drag, or lift. It's a great idea to make it one stone per point. I think that's an awesome idea. I can say. So a tasteful choice, fifth edition people. So the next paragraph it says you can push, drag, or lift a weight in pounds up to twice your carrying capacity, which is going to be 30 times your strength score. So 30 times 18 would give you 540. And that kind of fight, but this doesn't specifically say what kind of lift is it. Is it an overhead lift? Is it like a squat? Is it just like picking it up in your arms to your chest? That's now less clear. But if we do say that's like maybe an overhead lift, then again the 18, I guess it's more generous, right? Now just a basic 18 is getting you over 500 pounds. So maybe they don't mean an overhead lift. Maybe they just mean like a deadlift, squat, something. And now you're carrying, you know, 500 pounds at your feet, and you can shift it over like a couple yards or something like that. So, but that's a little bit unclear what they mean there. But you know, arguably in the ballpark of reality.
Okay. I got to admit, Dan, that these kinds of rules get into a level of granularity that I just don't want in my games. Like, why? Why do I care about this? Are you measuring the weight of things that the players are attempting to lift? Do you actually have written down this weight precisely, you know, 312 pounds?
Well, no, Paul. I mean, you know, I agree with you that I like things on a coarser level to make it easier to adjudicate. So what I have documented is the weight in stone.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. You got to pick the right unit. I totally agree with Paul on this issue, viewers. No, I completely agree. You got to pick the right unit that you're noting your weights in. And stone weight is the correct way of doing that. Yes. Handy, useful, utility. Agreed. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, for the purposes of when, you know, with the exception of maybe encumbrance, right, which frankly, let's put encumbrance aside for a second. We can talk about that in a minute. But for basic things, like, I'm trying to think of, like, when in the game would this come up? When would I care, right? Okay, there's a heavy portcullis, there's a huge boulder, there's a, right, we've got a lift, move, carry, whatever, this thing, this got to shift this object. Are you strong enough to do it? In those cases, I don't think I ever, like, even stone, I wouldn't have that information. I would write down, like, it's very heavy. It needs a 5 on a d6, 5 plus on a d6 to move. I don't think I would know the actual weights and care to look up and cross-reference that to, like, well, you got to have this level strength or this many strength points to move it. Just not a thing I would have in my games.
Yeah, to be serious about it, I mean, I think that the time that I would use this would be like in character generation, if I had to compare, right? If I was making an NPC, comparing to some character, like I want a character that's of this mode. I like being able to compare to a strong person, a professional weightlifter, something, some kind of real world stat that then I can convert into the game. So, in all seriousness, yeah, once I'm in the game, I'm going to have some kind of mechanic based on that number and probably not actually be thinking about the actual weight. But it's for my purposes, it's like pregame when I'm thinking about, you know, and I might actually look up, I've looked up density of stone for, you know, one of our favorite adventures, Lost City. There's a 10-foot diameter boulder that rolls at you at some point. And I actually have looked up what's the density, what's the weight? Can a person Is it legitimate for one person to be able to roll it, push it, move it? You know, and then I translate it into in-game mechanics that are going to be like on a D6 or something like that.
Okay.
So I don't mind that. I don't mind that. You know, and yeah. I'm currently playing a Star Frontiers campaign, and in that game, the stats, you know, the strength stat goes from 1 to 100, and the rule there is that you can lift up to, I guess, twice your strength in kilograms. So the strongest strongest person can lift 200 kilograms, which would be 440 pounds. Right? So I like that there's some kind of rule that if I need to, I can go anchor my game in concrete stuff.
Mm-hmm. I get that. I respect it, I will say. It's not a level of detail that I would ever want to care to research into. I just wouldn't do it.
So that's the easiest. Like, strength is by far the easiest. Where you can actually measure, you can pick some kind of exercise and measure it and get a number. That's by far the easiest. So now let's get into the harder stuff, Paul.
Sure, okay.
The second obvious ability score that was established in classic Dungeons and Dragons was intelligence, which of course is the prime requisite for your magic user class, which was the second class in original D&D, these 50 years ago now. So how do you measure intelligence? Now, I will say that classically, and this does get more contentious, but classically there was a very specific measurement for intelligence, and that was pretty consistent through multiple articles. Oh, you know, okay, you know, even in the, yeah, okay, I'm on the right topic. So this was actually consistent. All of the advanced D&D books all repeated this. And that was that intelligence, clearly the D&D intelligence score absolutely correlated to IQ, to intelligence quotient. And that is a thing that has been measured by psychometricians for many years. It has been, you know, the use of it has absolutely been abused in the past. But as far as, you know, my best understanding is that neuroscientists consider the general intelligence capacity, which sometimes they just call Q, to be very well established and a very good predictor of success in a number of areas. And to make a long story short, it seems pretty clear that the D&D intelligence score should also indicate 10 points of IQ per point. And the average IQ is established to be 100. So if you have 10 intelligence, that ought to be 100 IQ. And that is, if you pull up that image with the red dot again.
Wait a second. Yep.
So that's the last paragraph here on the image here, right? So after strength, there's intelligence. And it says the intelligence rating roughly corresponds to our modern IQ scores. However, it assumes mnemonic, reasoning, and learning ability scores in additional areas outside the written word. And it has that same reference in the player's handbook. And each of the monster manuals also repeat the same thing. So the monsters all get an intelligence score there in first edition. And it says the same thing in the preface to the monster manual. So that seems pretty well established. And again, I don't mind. I mean, that's a fairly simple conversion rule of, you know, the score times 10, again, there's your IQ. So that seems, again, if I need to think about who can possibly learn a language to what level, who can, you know, learn particular skills, again, if I'm creating mechanics, for me, that's a fairly useful thing to look up, and then I can go look at some real life research to kind of get some kind of basis on it.
There's been a lot of debate though about the validity of IQ as a measurement. Isn't that true? Right.
My understanding is that the counter arguments are overblown. And when I look this up, the current scientists and the current neuroscientists like Daniel Denning or somebody like that is the evidence for a general intelligence quotient Q that that does have a fairly high prediction value for stuff is very high. And again, the way that IQ has been socially misused in the past, I think has put a bad smell on it. But my understanding is it's actually fairly well-founded.
I thought it was strongly biased towards academic work. Is that not true? And then also, of course, I've heard
I'd have to look it up before
other biases implicit in it that are problematic.
Biases in testing in the past, absolutely, sure. Mm. Yep. Mm. Coming up, measuring the exact, you know, performance of Q, sure, undoubtedly. There have absolutely been bias tests. And that's part of what's given it a bad, you know, soiled smell, I would say. So the ability to properly measure it is still being refined, I would say.
Okay. I feel like it's enough that like I'm vaguely uncomfortable just having this conversation. It's not a road I would want to go down. I would certainly not want to start talking to my players about what their IQ scores are. Absolutely not.
I'm not surprised. That's well put. Thank you for saying that out loud. I appreciate it. And it is a place where I do think. Let's leave it at that. I actually do think that the science were anyway. I've said we've said our positions on that. My thing is it's scientifically useful, and if people are uncomfortable with it, of course you have to respect that.
Yeah, I mean, but it's certainly like I don't know. In general, if I take a step back, right, when we're talking about like, you know, games where players are asked to rank themselves in these statistics, right? That feels like a very, it feels like an exercise that would be prone to erupting into argument and conflict very quickly.
Well, I agree. I'm surprised that, I mean, once again, at the outset, if Arneson was running a game where people were basically playing themselves, if you literally have nothing to work from and there aren't any role-playing games in existence and you haven't thought of ability scores yet, I can imagine that, you know, like, so I'm running a game on Friday and frankly, the train gets disrupted. So my usual bit of study and prep for the game got wiped out because I had to refigure my travel plans, frankly. So I got there and I was like improvising a lot more than I normally do, frankly, Friday night because I didn't have my prep time. So I could imagine if I literally had never thought of statting out a character, I might have gotten there and go, you're just yourselves. And you're as tall as you are and you're left or right-handed the same way that you are and your vision's the same as you are. And the weather is whatever it is outside right now. So I can see, you know, grabbing for that. And I certainly, you know, it would certainly be hard pressed to imagine people running it that way now. It seems like, just like you said, Paul, it would be there's obvious problems as a game like that.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there is something enjoyable to me, the idea of role playing yourself, just in terms of like, well, imagine you're in this strange world, this strange setting, and how would you actually react, right? I think that aspect of it, just like portray your own personality, your own realistic. True. Reactions that can be quite fun, but yeah, once we get into like now write down your stats, I don't want to play that game.
Before we get off D&D, I want to, so there was an interesting article in Dragon Magazine number 8 in 1977, written by Brian Bloom, that specifically gave parameters for statting out all your real ability scores. And he actually does it for himself in the article. Now, amusingly, strength and intelligence are the easiest ones. There's some kind of real world measurement of some sort you can convert. And then once you get past those two, oddly, including the physical abilities, the article gets a little bit more jokey as it goes on. But it just might be interesting to know that it exists. So if you pull up the image with the green dot, there's this article that Bloom titled, "So you want realism in D&D?" And he said, I've had many players ask me about how can they convert how can they rank themselves in D&D abilities? And interesting, he says, this is an optional system which is designed to replace the old method of rolling three dice for each of a player's abilities, which is kind of interesting. So strength, which is basically just what we said, to determine strength, go to a gym. Military press as much weight as you possibly can. Divide the number of pounds you lifted by 10, and the result is your strength rating.
Okay.
There's a typographical error, as you'd have it. Intelligence, it says, sure enough, it says, to determine your intelligence, look up the results of your most recent IQ test you've taken and divide the result by 10. This number is your intelligence rating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, here's kind of the new stuff. Wisdom, to determine your wisdom, calculate the average number of hours that you spend playing D&D or working on your D&D campaign in an average week. Subtract that number from 20, and that's your wisdom. Yay! So
that's ridiculous. Oh goodness! Right. Oh dear! Oh dear!
And you know, Gary in advance talks about, like, you know, he's a chain smoker, which indicates that he himself must have a low wisdom. So I could imagine other things that people might possibly have addictive relationships towards. And here, Blyam, the first thing that jumped into Bloom's mind was your D&D campaign. So based on that, I have like a rock bottom level wisdom myself.
Oh my goodness. It's fascinating that we jump immediately to wisdom, because again, if I was going to, like, let's say I just wanted to rank the ease of which the ease of which we can measure these things, you know, in a real human, right? And here are the six categories of these things. I feel like wisdom is probably close to the bottom of the list for me. Right. In fact, I would put all the physical ones up top. Right. I would say, like, okay, strength, we're talking about weightlifting or whatever. Dexterity and constitution are a little weirder, but I can start to think about physical activities one could do and measure. Right. And then, you know, I don't know. And that's fascinating. Right. Like the constitution one, I'm super curious about. I can't read the text here. It's too small on my screen. But, like, I'm guessing something like holding your breath or enduring, you know, some kind of hardship or whatever, and you're just basically you're measuring time, right? And then dexterity, you can talk about, like, quickness of reaction or speed or you know, flexibility, or, you know, a lot of things that you could start is, right, again, because my brain's in, I've been watching the Olympics, is like, okay, there's a lot of Olympic events I can think of where I go, like, oh, that person would have a very high dexterity, that person would have a very high constitution.
Let's look at the, now, of course, remember that these are in the same ordering from classic D&D, and they're basically in the order that the classes were thought of. So fighters are first, and there you get strength. Magic users give you intelligence. Clerics are wisdom. Thieves are dexterity. So that was the classic ordering for it. But yeah, I totally agree. Let's look at those physical stats, what Bloom said. So for dexterity, he says, to determine your dexterity, go down to the track at the local high school and run 440 yards. Subtract your time in seconds from 80, and the result is your dexterity rating.
Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, and then this is where I feel like, gosh, now you're right, we get into that problem of, like, well, there's a lot of, what is dexterity? There's a lot of different things, right? Like, I watched the American gymnastics team compete, and it would not surprise me if you told me that many of them were quite slow runners. I would be like, not surprised. But would you say they're very dexterous? I mean, they're the gymnastics team. How can they not be dexterous?
I when I first read this, I agree. I'm minimally surprised that was the choice. Again, maybe it's a little bit jokey, but on the other hand, it's like, you know, measure something. I mean, it's something that's easy to measure, and maybe not the best, and maybe we'll come up with something better later on, but it might be among the easier things to measure. So I guess I can see why he went with that. But I agree, flat out foot speed isn't the first thing I think of, but with dexterity either. Now, for constitution, he says, to determine your constitution, figure out the number of consecutive months that you've gone without missing a day of school or work due to illness. That number of months is your constitution rating.
Huh.
Right?
Fascinating. Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. Not terrible. I mean, you know, crazy, not terrible. Now, now, obviously, you get sick and all of a sudden your constitution now becomes one. So I feel like constitution is basically one of those signs of like, we've had this many months without injury.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Updated, right?
Oh, gosh.
And then finally, and I would have thought that this would be really hard. Finally, here's charisma. Bloom says, to determine your charisma, count the number of times that you've appeared on TV or had your picture printed in the newspaper. Multiply that number by two. That's your charisma. Now,
what?
There are clearly infamous people, right, that have been widely depicted on TV and newspapers, and you can't, you know, obviously all those people don't have 18 charisma, quite the opposite. I don't know, maybe for the layman that's not actually in the public eye, I suppose, that's hard. I mean, I'm not coming up with a better metric. That's pretty hard, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, measuring charisma, definitely. I would certainly put it at the bottom of the list of how do you measure it, because they're all terrible. Any measurement of charisma is just awful, in my opinion. That said, honestly, it's also, I think, one of the hardest stats to explain to people, right? Like, what is it used for, right? Because, and there's been disagreement, I think, over the years, right? Of like, well, does physical appearance, is that part of charisma or not? Or is it just force of personality? Like, what actually is charisma? And I feel like I've heard different takes on it, right? Right. And then you have some games, right, where like, well, we need to separate those concepts. So we're gonna have a comeliness score that measures your physical beauty versus your ability to be convincing or whatever charisma is. And oh man.
Absolutely. And we have to confess that, like, very, very early D&D, there was a lot of, you know, the princess is beautiful, so she has 18 charisma. Happened quite a bit in very, very old texts. So that's probably not that. Probably not that.
That's hilarious.
What we're looking for. Now, Paul, I wanted to rope in your Fearful Ends game to the, and we could talk about a whole bunch of other games, including the Star Project. I wanted to rope in Fearful Ends, and so you released that last year. It is a great game, viewers. Please go to fearfulends.com to find out more about Paul's lightweight, easy to play. I don't normally run horror games, but I've run games with it. It works great. Fearful Ends game. And so when you're making characters, one of the first things you do, Paul, is you make your attributes, which are kind of analogous to D&D ability scores. So I don't know if you want to pull up the image with a blue dot that has your image on attributes. So lightweight, if you've never heard of this game, so easy to understand. So you have five attributes, brawn, agility, intellect, charm, perception. They're all ranked in terms of some kind of die. So you're going to make a brawn check, and you have a particular die you roll. It's either a d4, 6, 8, 10, or 12 at the max. And so at the top, and I think I snipped this out of the draft rules, but it's the same text as far as I can tell in the published copy. So you have some parameters like a small child may only have a d4 brawn. An ordinary adult would be d6. A fit adult who works out regularly would be D8, and a pro athlete would be like a D10 with only superhumans being D12. And then the last paragraph says how you're gonna determine this is when creating a new character, each attribute begins at D4, and then you have six up adjustments. So you can adjust dice up by one level six times to your satisfaction. That's how it is in the published rules at all.
Yep.
So, Mike. Yeah. So my question is, and it's funny that this question doesn't occur to me for D&D initially, but you know, when we develop our horror games in Fearful Ends, I feel like context matters. So some of our games will be like your characters are teenagers in high school, you know, getting lost in a haunted house. And one of my games was expert marine biologist explorers, things like that. So my question is, do you feel that the creation of the abilities should be adjusted by context? Or
no,
you feel like
I don't think they should. I don't think it does matter. And again, like that's the general. Again, like this is where we get into this is a lot. I'm going to express a lot of personal preference here, folks. So I'm going to start there, right? So when I'm running my games, and especially horror games, I'm looking for mood and tone and a cinematic quality. I'm not looking for simulating reality. Right. So I think that, you know, that it doesn't matter if you're playing a teenager or, a modern day teenager or a, you know, medieval era peasant, what have you. Right. And then the increments, you know, the increments are incredibly gross. Right. Like, first of all, you have to take D12 off the table because we just generally assume D12 is superhuman, which really means you've only got four levels here. Right. 4, 6, 8, 10. So it's you know, small, medium, large, and extra large. That's those are your options. Could you play a teenager with D10 brawn? For sure. Why not? And does that compare to a, you know, futuristic marine with D10 brawn, and they have roughly the same strength? But they have the best. They are the strongest person in the show that we're watching together. They are the strongest. They're at the top of the grade of what is in the content of whatever it is we're playing.
Okay, well, that's a different that is a different sensibility, and obviously, as you can tell from my prior rant, I do like to have things more tied to some concrete performance capacity, I guess, so that I can measure those kinds of things. So having it be relative, I guess, is what you're saying here. What wasn't, maybe that's the thing I needed to hear to be more comfortable with that myself, because my instinct would be that depending on context, and I think this only comes to mind because we normally have Fearful End games set in the modern world, right? Set hypothetically in the real world, and then something wacky, you know, something supernatural happens. So I guess I'm thinking more, my instinct was that depending on context, there would be a filtering effect so that, you know, people that were coming out of a refugee camp or something would be, you know, physically less robust than people that we knew had gotten into an elite military branch or NASA or a top level, you know, scientific researcher or something like that. So my own instinct was to adjust that generation protocol for that kind of filtering effect, which is something that I certainly analyze in, you know, D&D character generation a lot myself. Well, that's an interesting take.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, the interesting thing I think is that what we're picking at here is the stylistic difference, yeah. I think. And between how you and I prepare our games, right? I'm reading that you are much more simulationist, where you want the rules to emulate the real world, whereas I am a little more removed, where I want my games to emulate fiction. I want them to emulate books or television or movies, which I'm already acknowledging are pretty far from reality.
Got it.
Yeah.
What if we... Have you seen the Reacher show on Amazon?
I have not. I don't know what that is.
Okay. Okay. So, initially based on a book, I think it's now in its third season. So Reach, and I just saw the first season a couple of weeks ago, which is on why it's on my mind. And so features a main character named Jack Reacher, who is an ex-military police officer. And it's funny because the show, the character reminds me a lot of the pulp character Doc Savage, right? And Doc Savage has a scientific pulp exploratory team, and Doc Savage has the best qualities of all of them. And so the Reacher character is basically, and this is kind of my take, and I haven't seen other conversations, maybe people disagree, is basically an Ubermensch, right? He mm-hmm. is an enormous person. He is incredibly physically strong. The first time he gets arrested in a police station, he just snaps the cuffs off, played by an enormous actor. He mm-hmm. is also a trained investigator, police detective, constitutional theory scholar, wildly knowledgeable about laws and people's rights and investigative techniques. And so basically you have this, can also talk people into, you know, whatever he wants. So basically you have this Ubermensch character who kind of runs the board in like all the qualities. And then trouble finds him wherever he goes. Trouble has a mm-hmm. has a funny way of finding wherever he is. Is that something that is outside the scope of Fearful Ends, or could you imagine
having
a way
to play that kind of character? I mean, yeah. I could imagine statting out that character. Now I will point out. You know, when you get into the bestiary, even though they have the same stats, they don't really follow the same rules. And certainly some of like my big, yeah. horrible creatures have, you know, stuff in the D12s and then additions on top of that. Right. If you really, could I make that character in Fearful Ends? I mean, it sounds like he has D10s and everything, or maybe even D12s in some things because he's better than a normal person could possibly get. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be my instinct myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I could imagine using that for a solo game, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, it's not really in the, like the character you're describing feels to me also like maybe not really in the tone of Fearful Ends, right? Fearful Ends is not about my adventure, right? Fearful Ends, the point of Fearful Ends is to fail, for your character to come unraveled and either self-destruct or be destroyed by their environment. So, as long as you're okay with that character meeting a fearful end, you could play that character. I just want to go back, like, one of the things I think is one of the reasons possibly I like this this very gross scale, right, again, of like really like, you know, if you boil the dice down to just a base number, it's 1 through 4. If we talk about, like, I'm just gonna pick on Braun, right? So we talk about a game, you know, where you're playing teenagers and I've got a character who's D10 Braun, right? And versus say a game that's like, you know, modern or even futuristic military, and I have a character who's been training his whole life in military endeavors with a lot of physicality and et cetera, and he's super strong, and he's also D10 Braun. You know, I might argue, first of all, that your teenager, right, in my little scale here, I mentioned that, like, D10 is, like, professional athlete. So I'm assuming that this teenager is about to be drafted for, you know, his football skills or their football skills or... right, or they're all on the track to become an Olympian or something like that, right? This is clearly, you know, somebody, even though they're currently only in high school, they're clearly on track to be one of the strongest people that we're aware of. But say compared to somebody like our highly trained, you know, older soldier person, Marine, right? So first of all, well, the Marine's going to have a lot more skills, right? They're going to have a lot more skills. And as you know, in Fearful Ends, all roles are a combination of an attribute and a skill. So they're probably more likely to succeed at things because they're going to have higher skills. Also, you have the perk system, right? So a Marine is going to have perks like I've been trained, like, you know, highly trained, or access to, you know, again, if it's futuristic, you know, bionic strength or access to performance enhancing drugs or whatever, right? So they might have stuff that's going to give them extra bonuses on top of that, where you're going to get a little bit of gradation there, where you could say like, yeah, okay, so we think, you know, toe to toe, maybe our extreme futuristic Marine, even though he has the same base score as our, you know, high school football player, probably the Marine's going to win.
Great. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And I was similarly, I was thinking of, you know, other games like, because I was trying to come up with like arguments for the same point. I was thinking about Traveller. People come out of generation with wildly different backgrounds, more experience, less, and that gets reflected in, I think, some the classic Traveller, some ability scores and a lot of skills. And I looked at Star Frontiers, which has an option in the campaign book for characters coming out of Starfleet. And again, not any difference to the abilities, actually, but a whole bunch of extra skills that you're starting with. So that certainly makes a lot of sense. To the extent that you know, people might be more or less fit, or you know, more or you have better or worse nutrition growing up, or things like, or be selected for you know, flat out size. I could imagine from my standpoint, like when I did a game with that had elite explorers. I did boost the number of starting ability scores actually up on my end. Now they still all wildly expired by the end. that feels for kids. They were wildly wiped out by, I believe, both nuclear devices and Cthulhu-esque cosmic horrors both. But I did actually boost up the ability scores a bit to reflect people that were selected for, you know, both physical attributes and also raw intelligence at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't see why you couldn't do that. And, you know, let's be honest, that mechanism of having a couple of attributes and a skill and a combined role and whatnot, a lot of that is inspired pretty heavily by, the game Savage Worlds. And, if you look at the way Savage Worlds handles this, you know, you have these stats and they're going up by tie type, but then they also have an experience system. And so the number of advances you're going to get are based on this experience system. And one of the things that Savage Worlds will tell you as you're looking at different Savage Worlds contents is like, this is for, can't remember exactly. They have kind of like four categories, I think, of how experienced you are. It's like novice, veteran, something, something. I can't remember what it is. But they'll maybe encourage you to like, oh, you need like veteran level characters. You need, you know, professional level characters, whatever they call them. But the funny thing is, of course, like the idea of an experience system really doesn't work in Fearful Ends, right? That's that had to go.
Yeah.
Right. But that okay. said, you could certainly do a scenario of Fearful Ends where you're going to say like, well, I want my player characters, instead of starting with 6 advances in their stats, to have 8 advances or 10 advances or whatever you want. You could end up with characters who are by and large better than the average, than what the book states. But I found like, again, the numbers that are in the book are just from, you know, years of playtesting of what I found to make enjoyable experiences.
Great. Great. Yeah, I did boost them up for my game for that exact same understanding. So I'm glad to hear that's on the it's good to think about the skill system in addition to that, and it's also interesting to hear your thoughts about a little bit of relativity depending on which I can totally see. Yeah. I'm glad I asked actually, because that's a good observation.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mr. Designer. We're out of time, Dan. What you got? Any final thoughts on? Wait, what's our topic here?
I like having a conversation with you, Paul, to get the two sides of like how simulative we do like to be. Again, I like to have. You're right. I like to have a bit of a simulation grounding, and to be able to tie in those things back to real world measurements, and that does. You know, answer some questions for me on occasion. And I also like hearing the counter experience of how it's worked for you to hand wave that a little bit more and make the game a little bit more easy to handle, perhaps. I do like having some real world basis for measuring and statting characters And I'll even say it's kind of fun to use that as a gauge for your own personal fitness goals. And so as myself and our friends try to actually dial up our personal strength scores, it's kind of fun to be able to come back and compare to see where we are in D&D. So that actually is a little bit of a benefit too.
That is hilarious. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, I think, Dan, in the show, you know, when we get into the nitty gritty, a lot of times you and I agree on a lot of points, right? So I think a lot of our show is us like more or less agreeing with each other. So it is fascinating to find these little points that we disagree on. You know, not only like I'm sure people, you know, enjoy us bickering about you know, whether to use stone weights or not. But what's really interesting there is not like, do you like stone as a unit of measure, but just like what is the core value that we're putting into our role-playing experience that is driving that choice? That's really fascinating. I feel like this episode of Wandering DMs, we maybe got closer to that discussion where we actually do diverge quite a bit, which is really fascinating. Yeah.
I'm glad we got to touch back, because you and I have touched on that conversation personally. So I was looking forward to kind of a deeper conversation on exactly that point.
Very cool. Very cool. Viewers, if you have opinions on how to best measure real life humans, whether they're yourself or celebrities or characters of fiction in D&D stats, please leave us a comment in the YouTube video comment section. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will give a little more grist for future conversations for us.
And remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on sites like YouTube and Twitch, Facebook, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please hoist up that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, perhaps while you're doing your commute or your housework or what have you, you can find those audio recordings on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here every week. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversations are continuing around the clock about D&D and old school and new school and horror games and science fiction, miniature building and all kinds of stuff like that. And you'll get to join us in our live video after chat starting in about 10 minutes. There on our Discord video chat channel. So we'll enjoy seeing you there and your continuing ideas about ability scores and statting real people and some like things like that. Thank you for finding us today. If there was there might be a little bit of a glitch in the link on this particular show that we'll be fixing right afterwards. So thanks for continuing the hunt and actually finding us in the live show today. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another episode.